Good afternoon. Welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace. Very pleased that you could join us for this important presentation. Professor Al-Tayyib Zain Al-Abdini is a good friend of the Institute, and we're very privileged to have him here to speak to us today. He is co-founder and general secretary of the Sudan Interreligious Council since 2003. And I need to recognize Doug Johnston here from the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy, who was a key player in the founding of that institute as well. Al-Tayyib has a PhD from Cambridge in political history. He's been a professor of politics. He was dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the International Islamic University in Islamabad in Pakistan. At that same university, he was vice president and dean of the Faculty of Sharia and Law. He's also been director of the Islamic African Center. He's published over 20 articles and a book of academic character and quality on Middle East politics and Muslim political thought. And currently, he writes two weekly columns for Arabic newspapers in Khartoum. He is a very influential public intellectual in Sudan and has been very successful in bridging the divide between Christians and Muslims and bringing them together. The Sudan Interreligious Council has been an important partner of USIP. His organization co-sponsored with our training program two different training projects, and at the end of July, my program on religion and peacemaking co-sponsored a very successful workshop in Khartoum between Christian and Muslim leaders from North and South to talk about the role of religious leaders as peacemakers in a post-peace agreement Sudan. And we're now talking about follow-up activities to, again, promote the role of religious leaders as peacemakers in Sudan. So it's a great privilege to have Al-Tayyib with us here today, and we're looking forward to hearing what he has to say. While normally we would ask speakers to stand here so can be more easily seen rather than stand here and hold his cane, we've allowed him to sit down.
I was trying.
Ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
And if I couldn't do it, continue so.
Okay.
I think you will excuse me. Thank you, Dr. David, and for your introduction. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am grateful to the United States Institute of Peace for inviting me to Washington. It is not a very easy exercise to come to Washington. So I am very grateful for them to give me this opportunity. I was asked by my friend David to speak about my organization, Sudan Interreligious Council, and peacemaking in Sudan. So first I speak about the establishment of this organization. It is an NGO organization founded mainly by two organizations in Sudan. That is Sudan Council of Churches and Council of International People's Friendship, Council for International People's Friendship. This is a semi-government organization, and the catalyst who brought these two institutes together is International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. And we owe much to Dr. Douglas Johnston for persistent effort to achieve this. Actually, David said that I'm a co-founder of this organization, Unfortunately, no. I was recruited to by the founders, that includes Douglas, to come and be the executive administrator of this Sudan Inter-Religious Council. And I'm happy that we managed to bring for the first time Christian leaders and Muslim leaders to sit together in a voluntary organization and exchange ideas and discuss real problems. It is not a theoretical religious dialogue. It is things, how can we live together in peace? And that's very, very important. And one characteristic of this organization is that it's equally divided between Christian and Muslims. We have two forums, the General Assembly, 46 members, half of them Muslims, half of them Christians. In our executive bureau, 12 members, half of them Muslims, half of them Christians. And every body or committee we create, it has to be half Muslims and half Christians. And I think the religious leaders themselves were surprised that they agree on many, many things. The dialogue mentioned by David, which was held last July, they reached 13 agreements. It is published in this small booklet, and all of them were passed unanimously. And the subject was the role of religious leaders in peace building in Sudan. So if Muslim leaders and Christian leaders could agree completely on what do they should do in peace building in Sudan, I think this is a very, very good sign. The objectives of this organization is to strengthen values of tolerance and coexistence among different religious communities, to undertake dialogue among religious leaders, and to consolidate values of peace and national unity, and to protect religious freedom. We include the major religious communities in Sudan. On the side of Muslims, we represent in the two levels, on the General Assembly level and on the Executive Bureau level, we represent the major religious communities. That is the Ansar, the followers of the ancient Mahdi, and the Khatmiya, and the Ulama Association in Sudan, and some of the big Sufi orders. On the side of Christians, actually, we include Sudan Council of Caliphs. Right now, the president of SIRC is the Secretary General of Sudan Council of Caliphs. And in Sudan Council of Caliphs, there are 12 caliphs, including the Coptic caliph, including the Catholic caliph, something which is not very common in other national council of caliphs in Africa or otherwise. So we can claim that we represent the major religious communities in the Sudan. Unfortunately, we do not represent in our council and the animists, the followers of African traditions. And again, that was unanimous by both Christians and Muslims, because both of them recruit from the animists, really. So that's why they don't like to represent. But I think it is one of our shortcomings. We have to do it. At least on level of experts, who are experts on traditional beliefs, should be included in our. And we have in the coming 2 months, we will have a general assembly. We hope we will do so. The second point I want to talk about is the role of religion in Sudan in general, and the divisions which are created by religion in Sudan. the biggest division in Sudan is between the north and south. Unfortunately, we don't have a map for Sudan. Otherwise, it would have make it easier to explain. But anyway, the biggest division in Sudan is between the north and the south. And the problem started actually before independence. The first rebel movement in Sudan took place in August 1955. That is about 5 months before independence, because we got our independence in January 1956. So the causes of the problem, to me, is historical, that during the British administration, Sudan was divided completely between north and south. Even the British administrators in the south used to consult with British administrator in Tanganyika, the present Uganda and Tanzania and Kenya, not with their British colleagues in the north. So the country was literally divided between the two. Again, the level of development in the south and the north was at disparity, even during the British time. The north was relatively more developed, more educated, politically more conscious than the south. And it remains so up to this moment, so that the national governments also have their blame of keeping this disparity going on all that long time. Racially, the people of the south are considered more African, or purely African, if there is something called purely African. And the people of the north are of mixed Arabs and Negroes. And you have this color, which is neither completely black nor white. And this is the color generally. And culturally, the people of the south have maybe 100 language or more, very local languages. They have their own languages, different from the north. They are mostly animists and Christians, and few Muslims in the south. So the divisions is historical, political. Again, politically, the government, all this period, was mainly dominant by people of the north. And of course, in terms of number, the north constitute 75% of the population, and the south 25%, in addition to the other factors. So politically, is a reason for division. Economically, culturally, I mean, all these two. Religion also became a factor. It became a factor for two reasons. One, because most of the leaders in the south, maybe 90% or so, most of the leaders are Christians. Why? Because during the British period, which continued for 50 years, education in the south was completely in the hands of missionaries. So everybody who went to school became a Christian. Even some Muslims who went to this school, who joined those schools, again, changed their religion and became Christians. So the leadership in the south, up to this day, mostly Christians. Although if we go to the religious map of Sudan, which is an estimate figures, I would say the population of Sudan may be about 36 million. 75% are Muslims. 13% or 14% are animists. And those animists mainly in the south and in Nuba Mountains, and few of them are in Blue Nile. And about 11% are Christians. This is in the whole country. If we come to the south separately, then the proportion of animists and Christians will be very obvious. I would say the animists in the south, maybe 5.5 animists in the south. That is about 46% of the people of the south. and the Christians would be about 4.5 million. That puts them about 37 point something. And the Muslims in the south, there are also Muslims in the south, about 2 million. That make them about 16.5%. This percentage is now, but after independence, where there was a census in which religion was also asked about. In that census, the Muslims were more than the Christians in 1954. But things have changed since that time up to now. So religion was not part of the problem at the beginning between Muslims and between southerners and northerners. But it became part of the problem during the late period of Nimeiri and during the present government. Not exactly the present government, because now the present you have a government of national unity, but the Salvation Government, which was in power since 1989 till the signing of the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, in 2005. So it became part of the problem, and in fact, this is why the founders of this of my organization, Sudan Interreligious Council, thought of establishing this organization to try to solve the practical problems between the two religious communities. There are other divisions in Sudan, besides north and south. Now everybody has heard about the conflict in Darfur. The conflict in Darfur is not religious at all, because, 98% of the people in Darfur are Muslims. But it is economical, it is political, again, because of the disparity between the region of Darfur and the center. So the conflict is between the center and the marginalized areas. It's not it's not between the north and another region, because Darfur is part of the north. Equally, the Nuba Mountains, the Blue Nile, and eastern Sudan. So it is between a region which considers itself marginalized and the center, which is dominant by the people of the middle of Sudan. And because it was a very much central government, so the peoples of the region did not have their share of the political authority or the wealth of the country. If I focus on religion and the role of religion in the division, I would say the complaints mainly come from Christians, not from the animists, because the animists are mainly very local in their practice, in their traditions, and in their rituals. So, and every tribe has its own traditional belief. It is not something unified for people in the south or people in the Nuba Mountains. It is very, very local. So when they leave their areas, their local area, most of them no longer practice the animist rituals, maybe except in burials when they bury their dead. And when they get educated again, they more or less abandon the practice of their, and they don't ask for any facilities for their to practice their religion. So actually they don't constitute a problem. We came to other religious sects like the Copts and the Armenians and the Roman Catholics. By Roman Catholics, I mean the Orthodox Roman Catholics, whose headquarter is in Syria, not Catholics of the who follow the Vatican. Those groups are in the north, and they have been living in the north for long years. The Copts came since 1821, when Muhammad Ali conquered Sudan. The Armenians and Roman Catholic came later on. And those communities are small, but they adopt Arabic culture. They speak only Arabic language. Again, they are of fair skin. In fact, far more fair skin than the average Sudanese. So you don't feel that they have any problems. And they built their churches and the institutions and their schools long time ago, since the Egyptian-Turkish rule over Sudan, which continued even during the Mahdiya time. So the tension, or the religious tension, mainly come with Christians from southern Sudan and Christians from Nuba Mountains. They have certain complaints. They moved to the north. When I say the north, I mean the riverian north. That's Khartoum and upper the Nile till you reach far north in Sudan. They complain that they are not allowed to build new churches. This is one of their complaints. Second, they complain that the educational curriculum is heavily oriented by Islam. They complain that they don't have easy access to government media, that is TV and radio. They are controlled by the government. And they are complaining of certain decisions of the government, like the confiscation of the Catholic Club in 1997. It was taken by the government on the pretext that the release of the Catholic Club has expired, so the government is entitled to take that back, because the plot of land on which they built their Catholic Club was given free by the government for a certain period of time, I think about 35 years, so that was taken from them. And again, they complain that the conditions of IDPs around Khartoum are in very, very poor condition. So these are mainly the relationship between the southerners and northerners is quite normal. There is no religious friction between the common people themselves. And this is why we have in the north now about 2 million southerners who migrated from the south and came to the north. The question which I was also asked to address here is, can religion be a positive factor in peace building in Sudan? My answer to that question, yes, it can be a positive factor in peace building in the Sudan. Why? First, because I see that the relationship between southerners and northerners all over the Sudan and all over the north is quite normal, and it's a very peaceful relationship. So you don't find people who go and burn a church or attack a Christian because of being a Christian or doing something like that. This is something very, very rare in Sudan. And because religion itself was not part of the problem for more than 30 years, it's just recently became part of the overall problem for the reasons I already mentioned. And again, because both Islam and Christianity actually spread very peacefully in Sudan through ages, hundreds of years it took. And all through history, Sudan was a multiple religious community and society, and never had any religious war. Even the first Christian kingdoms in the north of Sudan, they followed two different denominations. Two of them were following the Malkite tradition, and one of them followed the Jacobite tradition. And in fact, two of them embedded together with different tradition and without any problem or without any war. And again, when they gradually Christianity died down in the north, again, it was without any problem, without any conflict, without any invasion coming from outside. Just the relationship with Egypt was cut off, and the relationship with Constantinople was cut off, so the Christianity died gradually. And the invasion, or the not the, the migration of hundreds of thousands of Arabs and Muslims into northern Sudan changed that situation drastically. Another reason is that Islam was very much influenced by Sufi orders. When I was young, that is 50 years ago, almost every Sudanese belonged to a Sufi order. Almost every Sudanese belonged to a Sufi order. And you know, Sufi orders are very, very peaceful and very, very pleasant people. They don't think they have right to be aggressive against anybody because he is following his religious practice or not. It's a very, very peaceful. And this is why the traditions of tolerance has been there for many years. Of course, by new influences coming mainly from our Gulf brothers and neighbors, things have changed, has changed little. But the dominant still is this Sufi character of Sudan, of Muslims in Sudan. To the extent that you can find, especially in southern Sudan and in Nuba Mountains, you can find in one family somebody who is animist, somebody who is Muslim, somebody who is Christian. And they are living very, very peacefully together. Actually, if we want to be very accurate, the solidarity of the family and of the tribe is stronger than the solidarity of religion. So this is why maybe in towns and in urban areas this has changed, but still it is the dominant characteristics of the whole of Sudan. So what is our organization is doing? Just let me give you two examples of that, that the possibility of religion being a very positive factor. These recommendations, when we come to when we come to discuss the role of religious leaders in peace building in Sudan, those recommendations were passed unanimously by the 40 or so religious leaders which we invited, half of them Christians, half of them Muslims. So that means religious leaders of both the major religions can really work together for peace building in Sudan in more or less smooth way. But the other incident, which again proves what I am saying, is after the death of Garang. When Garang passed away, or in that plane crash in August last year, there was a very violent reaction from the southerners living in Khartoum and living in other northern towns, like Wad Madani, like Port Sudan. They damaged cars in the roads. They killed some people, some of them children, women. They looted some shops. That was on Monday, I think. And then a reaction came from the northerners, again, southerners, on the next day, on Tuesday. We, in our interfaith organization called the Religious Leaders, the Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church. The Catholic Church is the major church in Sudan. They claim followers of about 2/3 of the followers of Christianity are with the Catholic Church. That may be exaggerated a bit, but nevertheless, it is the biggest church in the Sudan. The second is the Episcopal Church. And we appeal to the Ulama Association. There is an Ulama Association for the whole country, and to the some religious leaders within the Ministry for Religious Affairs. All of them accepted to address publicly and through the radio, through TV, to address the public that to calm down. All of them responded positively, and they made statements through these medias. And in fact, we published them in the papers also. And only after 2 days, things have subsided down and became normal on Thursday, I would say. It took Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and on Sunday, things became normal in Sudan, although it was very, very ugly incident. So that shows that the religious leaders can play a positive role. Strange enough, I don't know if David remembers this or not. In our recommendations, which was before the incident of Garang, we envisaged that such a thing may happen in Sudan. And we mentioned that religious leaders should play a role in it. That is a recommendation which started with organizing joint meetings among religious leaders, government officials, and political figures to exchange information and consult on tackling problems and specify duties that could be fulfilled by religious institutions, especially in cases of unruly behavior, instigation or aggression among followers of sects, which might create and threaten peace and unity of the country. Mm-hmm. So that recommendation was passed even before the incident of Garang took place. And those religious leaders responded very positively and managed to contain. It's not only we who did that, we must be fair. All the political parties, SPLM, the government, the Umma Party, and other civil organizations also appealed to the public to calm down. And with all these joint efforts, really, things calmed down in very, very few days. I mean, if you compare this with riots which take place all over the world, usually it continues far more longer than that. So what we meant, can I have that water? So what did we do during our short life period? We were established in 2002, this organization. It became active. Thank you very much. It became active in July 2003. We concentrate and focus on solving problems, not on theoretical religious dialogue. I don't remember in all our meetings we discussed any theoretical problem at all. So we focus on problems, and we picked the problems which the Christians complain, being in the north, and Christians are minority in the north, so we, and they are the leaders of the southern Sudan. So we thought we concentrate on that. And we concentrate on this problem, and I tell you what we managed to do during this short period which we had. The Catholic Club, which was very strong case, and Christians felt very strong about it, and in fact they publicized that their Catholic Club was confiscated all over the world. And you know the Catholic Church are very, very efficient in and their wide bureaucratic structure. We approach both. We approach the government and we approach the Catholic Church. By the way, you remember, Doug, that at the beginning the Catholic Church refused to join our organization. And Sudan Council of Churches, the majority being from the other churches, so they decided to join. So the Catholic Church did not join. But after 1 year, after they found out that we are serious, we can solve some of the problems, they joined us. So now they are represented in the executive bureau of our interreligious organization. So we approached both of them. Why not reach a settlement on this issue? The club cannot be retained to the Catholic Church again, simply because the government gave it to the ruling party to make it its headquarters, and they built many halls in it. It is no longer a club. I mean, it became something completely different. And we approached the government that you should compensate the Catholic Church, because even the law allows such compensation when you take back a plot of land which it is release has expired. So the government accepted first, but the Catholic Church took some time before accepting. Eventually they accepted, and we negotiated the settlement between the government and the Catholic Church, and eventually they were given another piece of land, and they were given financial compensation for the buildings of their club, and that problem was solved once and for all. The second problem which we tried to solve is of a strange nature, actually. There is a Christian cemetery in Khartoum. Am I still within the time?
Yes, okay. 5 more minutes.
5 minutes more? Mm-hmm. Okay. That will allow me to say that I did not finish all the accomplishments because the time was... the Christian cemetery was in part of Khartoum, and then some of the clever traders are always clever anywhere in the world, they approach the priest supervising the cemetery and tell him that give them no objection certificate that they can build some of the shops in the cemetery or on the fence of the cemetery. And the person approved. Later on, he denied, but his signature was there. So the traders built or tried to dig the foundation inside the cemetery, inside the fence, so that they should not pay for the land. If they took the land outside the fence, they have to pay for it. So they built it inside the fence. And during the digging for the foundation, they unearthed some of the bones of dead bodies there. And that created a lot of friction among the Christians, especially the families who thought that those were their dead loved ones buried in that area. And the traders had all the documents which allowed them to build shops here. So again, we approached the governor of Khartoum, and I must express that he was very, very positive in it, and immediately he canceled the building permission which was given to them by the local authority. And he said no shops should be built there, whether inside the fence or outside the fence. This is just once and for all finished. A third problem which we managed to solve was a compensation for the Episcopal Church. The Episcopal Church built a school in southern Sudan in an area called Rank. That is near the border between the north and south. Anyway, there was a plan to build a highway from the north to the south, and that highway came over that school, and they had to destroy the school. And the local authority, realizing that they made a mistake by giving them that plot of land, which they should have known anyway, that it fell in the route which was decided long time ago of the highway. So they gave them another piece of land. But they said, you have to compensate us for the building because we have to build a new school there. And they complained to us, and we approached the Ministry for Roads and Bridges to give them financial compensation or do what. The minister first refused. He said the route for this highway was decided long time before they built their school. So if they build their school, they are mistaken. But we told him that it's not the mistake of the cake, it's the mistake of the local authority, which allowed them and gave them that plot of land. But eventually he accepted, and that school was now built, and it's running its course with students. But the biggest achievement we did is to manage to convince the government of Khartoum state to give 3 plots of land free to 3 churches, the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church and another third church called the Sudanese Church of Christ. And since 1975, there was no plots of land given to churches to build new church. So I think we managed to create some confidence between Muslim leaders and Christian leaders in Sudan. And being a voluntary organization, we can do more, especially when you have American sanctions, which does not deal with government bodies. They only deal with NGOs and civil society organizations. And we are thankful that we have managed to organize a number of workshops in cooperation with USIP. We organized 2 workshops on conflict resolution, one in Khartoum and one in Eastern Sudan. We organized a religious dialogue on the role of religious leaders in peace building in Khartoum. And we still have some proposals to do more. One of the proposals which we are working on now, and we think that it will be quite a good one if it's implemented, is to bring Muslim organizations and Christian organizations who are working now among the IDPs. We have 2 million IDPs in northern Sudan, and they have to go back, voluntarily, of course, to their original homes in Nuba Mountains or in southern Sudan. We managed to organize 2 meetings for those organizations, about 30 organizations, 17 of them Muslims and 13 of them Christians, so that they can present joint projects on the services of resettlement, whether medical care or education or providing clean water or building homes or development and agricultural facilities, etc., etc. All of them accepted this, that they can, and we approach also potential donors in ASID and in the Ministry for Humanitarian Affairs and International Cooperation, and some of the big donors, that they should give priority to those proposals, because it will give a very good examples to the common people who come across this experience that Muslims and Christians can cooperate together and can work together, and that will help a lot. So I thank you very much for listening attentively, and I manage to stand all the time.
Thank you very much, Al-Tayyib, for an instructive presentation on interfaith relations and peacemaking. We will have an opportunity for people to ask questions, and there's a microphone up here if people would like to line up behind the mic to ask questions. I'll take the prerogative of chair to ask a question. In your presentation of Christian-Muslim relations, some people here may think you might have painted a more pleasant and cooperative picture than actually exists. You didn't really focus much on the September laws of Numeri or on what happened in 1989 when the NIF government came into power and the Islamization policies. Could you say something about the current situation and how life for Christians may or may not be different from what it was in 1989 and the early 90s?
I can answer questions from here. That's, when you are working in an organization like ours, to keep going, you need to be optimistic. So you for giving that I have been optimistic, hopefully, because this is the only way which let you go on. Otherwise, why should we do anything about it? If it is hopeless case, let us forget it, and we can every dog can do his business. So I think I said that religion has become a problem, a factor. So I saw that I am addressing people who will understand what I mean by that. So I don't have to go into details. First, starting with religion. Now there is a detailed agreement on the provisions concerning religion in the CPA. It concerned, we published this in this booklet. We call it Religion in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. It is a detailed about religious freedom, religious rights, and legislated for a commission on protection of non-Muslims in the North under the presidency. So, and in our dialogue, you remember, David, that the first co-recommendation was this is very good provisions. They should be implemented seriously and honestly. And we are going to monitor how it's going to be implemented. I forget to mention that we constitute a committee for the protection of religious freedom. And we are thankful to Doug because he was the person to convince the British Embassy to give the seed money to enable us to establish this committee for protection of religious freedom. And actually, the head of this committee is a Christian from the Presbyterian Church. And we investigate in any complaints which we receive which violates religious freedom. So if this is a completely new situation from what have been going on in the past. So if we look forward, and we have to look forward, then I think these provisions are very good. And we are organizing seminars. Up to now, we have organized about 9 seminars, one-day seminar. It took a full day to disseminate the knowledge about these religious rights and religious freedom in this comprehensive peace agreement, and to discuss what problems are expected if these provisions are to be implemented and how to solve them. And usually we invite participants from both Christians and Muslims. And I think the discussions and those seminars were very, very informative and very, very instructive. This is about religion. So if this is done, I think it will completely reach a new situation compared with what happened in the past. If you are referring to the general political situation in the country, the CPA is implemented, but rather slowly. And this is for practical reasons rather than that any party wanted to overcome or to neglect the principles of the agreement. And it applies to both of them. The government failed to do some of the things which it should have done. Again, the SPLM failed to do some of the things which they should have done. For instance, I just give you an example. The SPLM did not withdraw from Hamash Koreb. In fact, they did not withdraw from the eastern part of the country. According to the agreement, they should have done this before the 9th of January. Now we are in February. They did not constitute the government of the 10 states in the south. The government on its it did not establish the commission to define the borders of Abyei. They did not again constitute the government of Khartoum, in which the SPLM should be partner. But I think it is for practical reasons rather than for any ill intentions, because you have to make compromise and you have to a lot of wrangling and a lot of bargaining go on really to do these things. You have to satisfy as many political forces and political figures as possible. But realistically, I think the implementation cut quite a level, an extent. But still, it is slow and less than many people have expected. But I think up to now, it will continue and it will go on, especially if the government managed to solve the problem of Darfur. That's another a new issue which upset the situation in the whole country. We hear now some optimistic expectations from the African Union Commission that they hope to reach an agreement in Darfur by March. Hopefully that it happened. So I think it is. But still there are differences. There are certain wrangling and disagreements on many minor issues, but if there is a will, there is a way.
Marty Bray.
Thank you. Good to see you again, Doctor. As you know, we led a interfaith delegation, the Abrahamic Federation of Muslim Christians and Jew, to meet you in Khartoum, and I too subscribe to the interfaith concept that faith without work is dead. So I wanted to know from the perspective of us here in America who are really concerned about interfaith work, what would you feel would be the most important things that we could do as an interfaith community, as of Muslim, Christians, and Jews? What would be the most important type of activities that we could involve ourselves in to help in Sudan, especially around the area of conflict resolution and, more importantly, in Darfur? Thank you.
Shall I answer immediately or? Yeah. The image of United States in Sudan is that it is very much biased with the Southerners and with Christians. And that image is not unfounded. There are real reasons for that. So I think since there are many lobbies going on with the government of United States to side with this or that, so I would like that the interface people to make their lobby so that the government be more balanced in their approach. Otherwise, they will not be accepted as a mediator, really. So up to now, there are many acts against the government of Sudan. There is sanctions. I have to go to Cairo to get my visa from Cairo to come here. So and that costs money and time. So so if that kind of if these sanctions are removed or reduced and the government become more balanced, I think people in the north and in the south and the government and the rebel movements are ready to listen. They know very much that the United States is the most powerful country in the world and they are behind most of the United Nations resolutions. But it has to be fair. It has to be balanced so that people's all parties accept it. But if it becomes partisan, it becomes part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
You want to identify yourself and then...
Dr. Mohammed, Ustaz, it's very good to see you after 50 years, as you said. But if not for the cane, you're still the same vibrant, straightforward Ustaz. We were young at the university when you left.
Don't tell me that I taught you.
Well, let me differ with you, and I will try. Yeah. It's very difficult to differ with you, but I think, first of all, I've been sitting there listening to you painting a country, a very complex country. I'm sure even Steven Spielberg would not be able to portray. And I think this cuts at the heart of the matter in Sudan, which is prompted... who is the Sudanese and the Hawiya? And I wouldn't even dare to speak about the Hawiya in the presence of Dr. Afifi. It is his headache and he's wrestling with it and he's the expert. But I think the problem in Sudan is that we consistently failed to understand this country, how it is being paid. I don't want to hang our dirtiness on the British colonization, but that is where it starts. They created this country not haphazardly, but with a design to foster problem, to foster dependency. My point is that they have done it in Sudan. They left the north Muslim and the south Christian. They went and did it in Nigeria. They left the north Muslim, the south Christian. They did it in India and Pakistan. So our political leaders have failed, or at least they're short-sighted. As you said, it started 1952, 1955. When we went for independence, we did not include the southern with us. As if they are not there. This is one. Many, many times again, and I'm going to come to make it short. 1983, the Sharia law, Hassan al-Turabi, Wiznemeri, they forced it on them, which let Garang escape and went to the bushes to try to fight for his presence in this country. Now, the third one. So that created or built up a sort of mistrust continuously. And we always felt to do that. Now I come and I'm a little bit surprised about this incident after John Garang's death. His aeroplane was missed for 15 hours. If you ask anybody, you miss an aeroplane for 15 hours, most probably it went down. Most probably nobody survived it. The government were there and you told me your body, the interface was there. How come you did not see that tomorrow this thing is going to be, with the mistrust that had been building all our life, that the southerner would think that this is a conspiracy and they have the right to express themselves? You know what happened? The second day, everything is fine. The schools are open. The markets are open. The government didn't do anything for a vice president's death. The blood that have happened that night is a criminal. It borders to the criminal. It could have been averted. A lot of people died, and there is a deepened the mistrust. And that's why now, even the CPA, the Southern are saying, no. The Northern are still not honest. Still, they don't want to do it. So we're going to come into this cycle. Thank you very much.
It's a comment, Knox, but I just want to correct one point, that Garang actually led his rebellion after the Sharia laws. That's not true. Garang started his rebellion in May 1983, 4 months before the implementation of Sharia. You remember that they were called September laws, so they were enacted in September. The main reason for the rebellion was that Nimeiri nullified the unity of Southern Sudan. According to the agreement, Southern Sudan should be one united region. It has one government, so Nimeiri divided into three regions without consulting the government, without getting the approval of his counterparts. So, but when Sharia laws, it became another argument. You remember Garang started as a communist. He was not that much bothering about religion at that time. But nevertheless, in terms of time, really, the rebellion started before the implementation of Sharia. But the Sharia laws exasperated the whole problem.
Al-Bakir?
Al-Bakir Mukhtar, senior fellow in USIP. I would like to welcome Dr. Taib Zain al-Abidin and to comment his the work of his organization, which is very important, I think. But Dr. Taib, I think now what you presented to us is, you know, the work of firefighters. When a fire, you know, broke up, then you go and try to put it out. And there is no work of preventing things from happening or addressing the core causes of all these problems that you described for us. Because if you address the problem, the root of the problem, then then you reduce a great deal of them. And I think the basic root of the problem is that the Muslims in the north, in their different organizations, political organizations, they failed to come up with a framework that they wanted to build a, you know, their politics on religion, but they failed to come with a framework by in which Christians and non-Muslims feel they are equal citizens of the state. And I think this is a major problem, because if in a country where we have at least, you said, one quarter of the country is non-Muslims, and others would, you know, dispute that, and we say actually one third of the problem of the country are not Muslims. So in a country with this sizable minority, say, of non-Muslims, to have Muslim thinkers, Muslim organizations, who do not come up with a reform formula in which non-Muslims feel they are equal citizens, enjoying all the rights that are enjoyed by the Muslims in their country, I think this is a major fail. And I don't know whether it is part of your organization or of your effort as an individual thinker is to take care of this problem or to address this problem. This is one thing. The other thing is your organization is focusing on the relationship between the Christians and the Muslims in the country. What about the other Muslims who are persecuted within Sudan, like the Republican brothers and sisters? And you know that these are now illegalized or considered out of law and banned, and they cannot perform their religious rituals in public. So is this out of your thinking? Thank you.
Thank you.
I agree, Dr. Bakir, that the national government since independence failed even to constitute a constitution. You remember that all the three democratic periods we had in Sudan, in none of them the political parties agreed to a constitution. And the differences were not only about religion, but about whether it should be a republican or a parliamentarian system. They differed whether to make a federal government or a central government. So there are many differences, including the role of religion in public life. So I agree with you that. But again, we admit that the democratic periods in Sudan amounted only to 10 years and a half out of 50 years. We were ruled by military dictatorships for more than 37 years. So that's a problem, really, that we didn't have a choice. And military systems all over the world, they are very centralized. I would think that the centralized system of government was one of the biggest problems in Sudan. Now people agree to a federal system of government, that's something good. They agreed to a presidential system, and that at least solved this problem. And again, they agreed to many provisions in the new constitution about human rights, about freedom, etc., etc. So I think under the new constitution, any religious community could practice whatever their religious affiliation. And I don't think, are you referring to the Republicans, the Al-Jamhurin? The Republicans were not banned separately. I mean, they were banned just like the other political parties as a whole. But there is no a particular act against the Republicans, either during this government anyway. But anyway, the new constitution, I think, allow them and give them. And already in the last few weeks, I started to read some material about the Republicans, that they want to come together and they want to form at least a pressure group, if not a political party. So I think this will be solved. Our organization is an interfaith organization. So they cater about the problems of religious communities, really, rather than about the problems of Sudan. Even the religious problems are quite big, so how could we bother about the whole of the spectrum of political problems? So, but I personally interested and do my contribution about the political problems, but in the columns which David referred to, rather than from within the Sudan interreligious. In fact, the peoples in Sudan interreligious council do not like me to write on other issues. They like they like me to focus on their what they think their issues. The problems in Sudan are complex, as our colleague here said just few, and I hope this is a new hope. But it does not mean that the thing is solved, not at all, far from it. But at least this agreement gives us a hope. If people work together and put their efforts to implement this agreement, and comprehensive agreement, and not just wrangle and bargain about being presented in the government or not presented, as what's going on right now, I think that will give Sudan a hope. And that will make unity of the country more possible. I used to tell the people in government that actually the Christians will vote for unity if you address their complaints. Why? Because Christianity has good presence in the north. They have institutions. They have schools. You know, the most famous schools in the north are Christians. Kamboni, Unity, Al-Rahbat, Al-Ittihad. I mean, they have real presence, real institution in the north. And 90% of the students in these schools are Muslims. They are not Christians. They have churches built since British in central of Khartoum, in downtown of Khartoum. So they have a presence in Khartoum. They have an institution. They have schools. So they would not like to weaken this presence of Christians in northern Sudan. But they have justified complaints. You have to address this. And I think you may trust them better than the politicians. They listen to me half-half, but I think I have made my point, and some of them are taking it up.
Congressman?
Yes. Thank you so much. My name is Walter Fauntroy, and as you know, I was in the delegation that came, and I was very much encouraged by the fact that an interfaith council has been formed. I've reached two conclusions as a minister and as a politician over the last 46 years. In religion, I have reached the conclusion that the Abraham Federation persons are all anointed of God to declare good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted and set to liberty them that are bound. And that has led me, out of my work with Martin Luther King Jr. and in the Congress, to believe that it is the responsibility of spiritual leadership to lead. Martin Luther King Jr. and a group of us Christian ministers at that time decided we would form an organization, and we call it the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That's one thing I've concluded. For 20 years, I was a member of the Congress of the United States, chairman of a subcommittee on international development, finance, trade, and monetary policy. And I concluded that people will use anything, race, religion, anything, to deny other people five things: income, education to make money, health care to live long enough to enjoy it, housing, and justice. And I concluded that there can be no domestic tranquility unless there's general welfare. And at the core of much of all that we're dealing with in the area of peace requires spiritual leadership that I found, if forthrightly exerted, enjoys the trust of those who distrust one another. So our purpose in coming was to try to bring an Abrahamic federation, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish leaders who understand that if Abraham is the father of the faith and Moses was a lawgiver and he didn't give 10 suggestions, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet other people's oil. I mean, thou shalt not covet. that you would get a reaction. And you had us to meet with, not you, but thanks to the government and others who were intimidated by the fact that a fellow with a reputation here was there, allowed us to talk to people on all sides. And we got the feeling that there was, unlike in the United States where religion is sort of peripheral, I found in the Middle East and in Africa, it's rather central, and that people will respond to spiritual leaders. So my question after all of that is simply this. We want to return, but I want to meet the current leadership in the government on both sides, and we've tried to put this together. We just ask you to help us to put that together, because we believe that if we get to the moral core and people get people to understand you ought to love your neighbor, not just because your religion tells you to, but in self-defense. I want my neighbor to have income, because if he doesn't have income, guess whose income he's coming for? I want my neighbor to have appreciation for education, because if he doesn't, he's going to destroy my schools for my children. I want my neighbor to have health care, because if he doesn't, I'm going to get TB. And so I just appeal to you not to be apologetic. For 20 years, I was known as the Reverend Congressman. Every time I stepped into a meeting, they said, "Oh, Lord, here comes the preacher." Because politicians decide who's going to get how much of what, when, and where in five areas. And if we are to have peace, then there has to be a role for interfaith leaders who are seriously committed to their religion. And I want to start there. And I want to ask you to talk with Marty about identifying for us who are the decision makers. And we'd like to bring some, I'd like to bring some people.
They are well known in Sudan.
We want, in the name of Allah, Jehovah, God, and anything else, who says, if you got any sense, you're going to make sure your neighbor has these five things so they won't have to come after yours. Help us, please.
Thank you very much. I will do. And if you cooperate with USIP, because now they have intention to come to Sudan often, I think we can manage to do something.
All I want to say is,
we've got to leave. Yes.
Right.
Leave. Yeah.
And that's what
thank
I want you to help me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, absolutely. Just come to Sudan. I will take you.
Yeah, no, I want to.
Ambassador Shin.
David Shin, George Washington University. I should have known it was a mistake to get next in line behind such an articulate minister and politician. I can't live up to that billing. But let me ask my question anyway. And it's really addressed to both of you, because I'm interested in where USIP sees the issue that I raise, in addition to the Inter-Religious Council in Sudan. And that is, you've talked a great deal, and I know based on what USIP has done in its interfaith work, it tends to be pretty heavily based on peace building, conflict resolution, that kind of thing. Has either organization been engaged in dealing with issues of religious of extremism, particularly in the case of Sudan, the Horn of Africa more generally, some of the Salafist views that you alluded to that are now coming across from the Gulf? There certainly are some instances in the Horn of Africa, not necessarily in Sudan, I don't know of any particular cases, where on the Christian side there have been some extremist cases of certain groups referring to Muslims as tantamount to Satan, for example. I know this has happened. Does either USIP or your religious council in Sudan hold workshops or try to deal with the whole issue of religious extremism?
We try to invite some moderates among extreme Salafi movement, but unfortunately they did not respond to our invitation in attending some of our workshops and our we intend to go on persuade them at least to attend some of our functions and then later on join us. It's a very, very small group in Sudan, especially the Salafi movement, but they are vocal and they control some of the mosques in northern Sudan, and they are active people. The good thing now, lately they have joined the government. Now they have one or two representatives in the government, two. So that means they accept now the system going on, and they accepted the new constitution. And I know that they took part in the making of the transitional constitution. But that does not mean the whole group is wholeheartedly supporting this. But I think it's a good first step at least. But it's a very small group in Sudan. I don't know of extreme Christian groups, really. But I know that Sudan Council of Kirkis refused to recognize Jehovah Witnesses. They have established a new group in Sudan, and there is another one also. But I don't think because they are extreme, simply because of their beliefs and traditions, that they are quite different from the mainstream of Christian Kirkis.
Let me just mention a few of the things that we are involved in, and I'll be a bit parochial in talking just about the religion and peacemaking program, but I mean, one notable example is the work that Al-Bakir himself is doing on Sudan and the origins of some extremism there. In Aceh, we've been working with the Aceh Educational Program in Indonesia to develop teaching materials based upon the Quran for use in the madrasas, for the ulama, for training of ulama on peace education, on democracy, on women's rights, all based on scriptural references developed by Achenese Muslim scholars. In Gaza, we've helped to establish the Palestinian Institute of Peace, working with an Islamist leader, peacemaker, Sheikh Imad Faluji, who's reaching out to extremists there to convince them of his own transition from one of the founders of Hamas to becoming a peacemaker. In Saudi Arabia, we've had one part of an exchange with Saudi religious scholars coming here, and that we hosted and organized meetings with Jewish leaders, Christian leaders, Muslim leaders, to talk about our differing perspectives on religion and politics and the situation in the Middle East. In Iraq, we have helped with the founding of the Iraqi Institute of Peace, which is the principal interfaith organization reaching out to all sectors of religious communities within Iraq and trying to promote moderation and peaceful relations, just to give you some examples. Yes, can you identify yourself?
Good afternoon. My name is Carter Wilbur. Thank you, Dr. Zane, for coming today. It's been very interesting. You said one thing that I found very interesting, where you said that you're in your discussions as part of the council, you were saying no theoretical stuff, only concrete. I found that very interesting, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on how well you think these principles apply, not on any religion-specific basis. Do these same principles apply in discussions irrespective of whatever particular religious groups are being brought to the table? Does it not matter what the particular tenets of that faith are? You're operating on a deeper level of something that is more universal, or do you actually sneak in relative theoretical concepts to each religious group at the table when you have these discussions? How general, how universal, or how specific, tailored to each group, do you have to make these things? Thank you.
If I understand your point correctly, we are focusing on Sudan and on the present situation in Sudan. And we know that there are very clear, specific problems which religious minorities, namely Christians, complain of in northern Sudan. I mean, there may be other complaints from Muslims in southern Sudan. So this is why, instead of discussing just general dialogue, I have been invited to more than 10 or 15 international dialogues on religion. They ask me, what is the situation of women in Sharia? What is the rights of non-Muslims in Sharia? I mean, theoretical things. So we don't deal with these theoretical things. We have a certain situation in front of us. So they are complaining 1, 2, 3, 4. So we try to. And I feel that since our organization is divided, half of them Muslim leaders and half of them Christian leaders, they agree more when they deal with a practical problem. I give you an example of some things which they differed very strongly, and then we avoided the whole issue. When the negotiations in Nifasha was about the status of the capital Khartoum, the government point of view that Khartoum is part of the North, and we agree in the protocol that the North could be governed by Sharia and the South will be exempted from Sharia. But the argument of the SPLM, the capital should not be considered of the North because it is the capital of all of us. So it has to be under secular laws. And that took a lot of negotiation. So some people in our council said, why not discuss this problem? And immediately they were divided. The Muslims were on one point of view, the Christians were on the other side. We said, just forget about it. Please, go on. If we can agree, then we can go on together as an organization. If we differ, we just leave it. So we drop it. We didn't, alhamdulillah, that the negotiators themselves managed to solve it in one way or another. So it is not something general or universal, no. It is the field work in Sudan. But there are many things which could be discussed on theoretical basis. But let us first start with this, which will build confidence. And actually now I can claim that we have built some confidence. This is why the Catholic Church, when at one time she was out, then she joined us again after one year. So I think if we manage to build confidence, then you can afford address some theoretical concerns.
Thank you, David. I want to just pay an added tribute to Al-Tayyib in terms of what he's doing. Someone mentioned earlier about not thinking about prevention, and he's too modest to indicate that he is, long before he made the connection with USIP, he initiated a number of workshops for young college-age students and the like on human rights and religious freedom. And those were very, very well attended and very lively, in fact, and I think very helpful. At one point early on, when I was meeting with the Christian religious leaders in the North, they told me to a person, and this was kind of surprising to me, they said, you know, we feel no constraints on our ability to evangelize. This is in the North now, not talking about the South. But what we can't do is we cannot get permits to build churches. And so the churches that they have in the North are used 24/7. people would fill the courtyards, and you could hear the singing for blocks away. But the fact that the council was able to not only get permits to build new churches for the first time in 25 years, but to get the land on which to build them, contributed by the government, which takes me to my last point. The fact is that this council, which exists in the context of an Islamic dictatorship, so it took an awful lot to get the government of Sudan to agree with the establishment of an independent body, part of whose mandate is to hold the government accountable. You know, and so that was a challenge. But an even greater challenge was to get this individual in the leadership role, because organizations are a dime a dozen. The thing that makes a difference is the leadership. And Al-Tayyib at the time was the dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences in Islamic University in Islamabad, Pakistan. So, you know, it took it was a real gesture on his part. He saw this as a history-making opportunity to come back. But he's held in very high regard by both faith communities, because since the outset, he was a leader in the Islamic movement in Sudan, but when the current regime took over in a coup in 89, he distanced himself and he criticized it. This was not the right way to seize power. So he has been an ongoing critic ever since. And so for them to buy into that was took a lot of doing. And in fact, 2 months before he was due to come, in his column he ran a piece about how he encouraged every self-respecting Islamist to distance themselves from the Khartoum regime. And I thought, my God, it's a death wish. He really doesn't want the job. You know? But so this just totally derailed everything. But then the government finally got him to the point where he said, okay, if you give up your column, we'll let this go ahead. And to his credit, he did not give up his column. And they eventually caved in, to the point where one thing that the council did recently, about a year now, held a major conference on Darfur, brought a lot of the principals together who had never had a chance to interact before. And that was against the wishes of the government. It was so successful that the government asked him for the copies of the reports afterwards, because it was, you know, provided a lot of helpful input. But this interreligious council, you know, just didn't come into being. It took about 3 years of effort to get it there. And the fact that it has such strong leadership is what's making all the difference. And so I, along with everyone else, just deeply grateful for all you're doing, for all that you're doing there, Al-Tayyib. And we wish you continued good success. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you.